way to heaven.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the future of film in Kingston.
Last week, Kingston Economic Development released a report with a strategic blueprint showing how mid-sized cities like Kingston can build their own film and media ecosystems. The Hyperlocal Ontario Action Plan, authored by Jason Jolly of Branded to Film and backed by Kingston Economic Development, Tourism Kingston, Frontenac Business Services, and Ontario Creates, lays out what's been done and what comes next to decentralize Ontario's film industry and build industries in big little cities like Kingston. Jolly sat down with CFRC and shared the vision behind the report.
What originally prompted me, and it was a theoretical exercise, is how would I build, like, how can you pioneer and build a film industry from scratch? And, you know, like a lot of folks say, well, don't we have a film industry, Jay? And I'm like, well, we have Toronto producers who will come and randomly shoot here every so often, but it's very hard. You don't really have a business model unless you can forecast it, like you can predictably do it. And so my thing was, if you want to build like a film industry, you kind of have to start with like producers and crew, and all the vendors have to be like a full stack entity in a town where, you know, that you can achieve that stuff, like where it's not just a bunch of crew members coming from Toronto that stay here and then go back every 5 days after they've done shot their limestone out and had their ways.
The goal of the action plan was to create a document any community could pick up and apply to their own creative industries.
The report came out of me wanting to kind of open source what we were doing as a model. So other big little cities like Kingston could, if they wanted to look to grow their own industry, this is a different way of thinking. A lot of it was to just write a very easy to read, plain report without any, or it's more of a business intelligence paper, I guess, without any jargon. So any municipality or even someone like yourself could pick it up and it would be very digestible. And you get a really good overview of like the history of film production in Ontario, where we are, and it's what the landscape looks like, and also how we can better support folks like myself, which is independent Ontario producers, you know, with these more affordable, efficient places to practice their productions or execute their productions.
The plan argues that the timing is right for decentralization of the industry from cities like Toronto and Vancouver. High costs and congestion in these hubs have made decentralizing production a necessity, according to Jolly.
Well, I think for anything, decentralization is something that's not just for, you know, like the film industry or even media or the creative industries as a whole. It's actually something that's an affliction of a lot of industries, which is, as you know, like when I first moved to Toronto in the early 2000s, there was like 4.3 million people. Today, that kind of greater Toronto Hamilton area is now 7.5 million. So that's a significant amount of downward pressure. And it's, you know, it's the same kind of thing that happens. Like when we were shooting, you know, we could shoot it, almost get permits anywhere. It was still very like free and independent. And there was a great scene there. But as kind of the bigger like Netflix and things get gentrified, and like even if you're like, say, a visual artist, like you used to live in this industrial loft because it was cheap and nobody wanted to live in it. But now that's where they want to put a condo. So these downward pressures are something that I think affect all kinds of creative industries. And for independent Ontario producers like myself, you know, between the affordability to live, the affordability to do, because we don't have a lot of money to do a production comparatively to, like, you know, if you look at an episode of Star Trek, it's $10 million an episode just for one episode of television. When you look at our little movie, it's like $1 million for one, you know, for a whole movie, which I know sounds like a lot, but it's not. So, you know, I think in general, I think, you know, for society to be healthy, we can't just live in one place. And especially when you have such a, you know, these big little cities like Kingston are super accessible. Like you're right in between Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa. We're about 5.5 hours from, you know, Manhattan. It's a terrific, you know, balance between rural and urban, you know, great nighttime economy, great restaurant scene, beautiful place to live. And with technology, like it, which is very democratized now, and especially now with things like generative AI and virtual production, you don't really have to live in a big city to do high quality production. And in fact, the tools, these democratic tools, are being more and more, you know, to open sourced in a lot of ways, where, you know, that you can, I believe, and I, you know, I mention this all the time, where I believe, a filmmaker with $5 million in about 3 to 5 years, whoever she is, will be able to, in a place like Kingston, make a movie that looks like $100 million today by the big studios because of these tools, and how fast these tools are, you know, advancing and just being easier to use.
The report covers two case studies. Branded to Film's first feature, Dead Mother Crimson, was a testing ground. It hired 60% local crew and proved an end-to-end production could be done in Kingston. Their follow-up this year, Doom Boogie, pushed things even further. Jolly shared some of the lessons learned so far about what can be done in Kingston.
We just kind of set this random benchmark where we said, well, we're going to employ 60% locals. We're going to figure out how to either, hopefully they have experience or a little bit of experience, or they're from an adjacent industry. You know, so what it did is that first said, not only is it viable, but I think it's like, it's kind of like a skateboard trick. If you can see it, you can be it. Like my surprise was, here I am 20 years later and nobody had done $1 million end-to-end production, like of like that was developed, pre-produced, produced. And once we were able to do that and show that it was possible to do that, I think it opened up a lot of people's eyes, including my own. It's like, wait a second, this is like a real thing now. We can do this. And so we said, well, so that taught me kind of the realization that this isn't just, you know, a theoretical exercise. So we said, here's the practical things. And we were able to train, like some of the stuff that we were really able to learn. One of them was we wanted to see, could we make production more sustainable, like really green production? Let's try and avoid, you know, just randomly throwing crap out and, you know, really think about kind of how we can reduce our carbon footprint and stuff like that through little ideas or just behavioral change. So once we had done that and we realized, well, we need to do another one. And I said, well, this time, why don't we target 75% local hires? And to our amazement, and we got to 87%. We actually over-indexed. And what I found was, you know, one of the things that we really didn't do very well on the first one was, again, talent behind the camera was one thing, but we had kind of, you know, we had met like local theater actors and stuff, and theater actors and film and TV actors they're very different muscle set in a lot of ways. There's a lot of things that are similar, but there's just different ways of execution because, you know, film is very much, you can actually whisper, where theater is it's a lot bigger, like in terms of, so what we did is, you know, on this one, we said we need to make a real concerted effort to tap into actors or in front of the camera. And because of this particular movie, Doom Boogie was kind of about this fictional Kingston band, we decided to look at musicians. And a lot of the folks both on both sides of the camera were actually, and again, I really believe in supporting local musicians, especially because, you know, music is a very, very tough industry. It's more than ever. And so we were able to hire them in technical positions. But what was really great is we were able to hire folks like, you know, Kira from Tiny Horse and Jonas in kind of lead actor roles. And what we've discovered there is that actors kind of have 70 or I should say, sorry, musicians have kind of 70% of that thing they need from being performers on stage to be actors, especially like film actors. So that was a great revelation. So that's something we learned on it too. And then consequently, they also contributed to the soundtrack. So we were doubly blessed with that.
According to Jolly, it's not just the lessons learned so far that will propel the industry's growth, but also what the city itself brings to the table.
When people ask, well, what's the secret to your business? I say, or what's your superpower of your business? I always say, my superpower is Kingston. Kingston's like so cool. Like, I'm sure the secret's going to get out. And it's just like, what I learned was, because even on our first movie, we had like 40% were heads of department from Toronto that came and trained. And this one we had even had less. So 13%, and some of them were actors, as well. So, but what's interesting is when people came to Kingston, especially technicians from outside, what I realized is a lot of people, unless you went to school here or you were born here, most people have never been to Kingston. And they've driven by it on the 401 and all that kind of stuff. But what was interesting is, you know, usually the first night, like somebody from out of town, like especially, you know, like an actor or film was like, the first thing to ask is like, where's a good place to eat? And you kind of say, well, you just open your hand and say, just go down here. And then literally the next day on set, they were like, when are you doing your next movie? How do I move here? This is unbelievable, this place, you know, from, you know, just the beauty and stuff of being in the Thousand Islands, I think, and just the general, you know, what I like to say is sometimes it's like Kingston kind of feels like it's at that kind of stage where it feels like that super cool neighborhood in Toronto, like in the early 2000s or late 90s in a lot of ways, because everybody kind of knows each other. You show up at bars and everybody's kind of like connected in a certain way.
Still, turning this potential into a sustainable industry will take work. Jolly dove into some of the work that's being done right now to bring the plan to life, as well as the challenges.
Our big focus is we're down to is, you know, over the last 6 months, we partnered with the Tourism Kingston and are really, and also the city of Kingston in terms of, you know, we bought secured some land out in St. Lawrence Business Park, 10 acres. We've been working with a really great design construction firm. We just submitted our site plans. We're about just over, you know, call it between 75-80% finance. So we're just trying to close that last like $5 million. So that's kind of like our full court press. You know, we have a couple term sheets right now, and that's kind of, you know, just trying to find the right deal. It's been a really tough year, as you can imagine, especially for us, between the LA fires that started the year and then two provincial elections and now our provincial and a federal election. And now, you know, this wild orange man that thinks he's king yelling tariff, tariff, tariff everywhere. That's caused a massive distraction, in terms of not only equity, but just getting government attention. So, you know, one of the things we're in discussions with, the provincial and federal government in terms of bringing in some matching funds, because this is, you know, like this is creating jobs, significant amount of jobs, but you know, that's kind of, so where we are now is, you know, we'd love to just close the financing. There's a few other kind of opportunities percolating, and, you know, we're always working with like my colleagues, in Toronto, other producers to really lure them and kind of show them, hey, look what we did. You can do this too. You know, like, because sometimes, like I said, like that, I really believe as like a skateboarder in my youth that, you know, if you can see someone do a trick, you can do that trick too. So it's kind of like, and that's what I think. It's like, now that we've done two, it's not like the first one could have been a fluke and now we've done a second one. And I was like, okay, there's something here. You know, within the next 10 years, Kingston has the potential to capture, you know, say 3% of Ontario's film and television. Realize that industry is $2.65 billion. Like, and of that, in terms of domestic production, which we're kind of focused on here in Kingston initially, it's about $910 million of that $2 billion is just domestic producers like me. So if we can create that new, affordable, efficient home, you know, we could see, you know, if we over-index in terms of what we're forecasting, Kingston could be, you know, like an $80-100 million industry within the next decade. It's totally doable.
To view the full Hyperlocal Ontario Action Plan, you can visit investkingston.ca/creatives. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Napanee Beaver, Sarah Williams, about the Town of Greater Napanee's decision to disable comments on all town social media channels.
Thank you, Jesse. Those who followed the Town of Greater Napanee on social media may have noticed the absence of commentary over the last few days. On Wednesday, July 23rd, the town announced it would be disabling comments on all social media channels. When asked what prompted the decision to disable comments, CAO Matthew Grant pointed to ignored several instances where members of the public used town platforms to disparage individuals and/or groups. At times, these disparaging comments have been made anonymously. Greater Napanee is not alone in its decision to disable comments on online platforms. Victoria, Montreal, and the township of Addington Highlands are just a few examples of jurisdictions that have done the same. In the case of Addington Highlands, the council decided to enact the unreasonable behavior policy to disable online comments. Their motive has been noted as necessary to create a safe, productive online environment and to protect staff from online harassment. While the public may no longer be able to comment on town affairs on official town platforms, they are still able to do so on non-municipal social media channels. For those who might criticize this change, the CAO is careful to point out the numerous ways the public can still express their opinions. Residents are encouraged to ask questions or report concerns by reaching out to the Town Council directly via email, phone number, or by referring to the staff directory on the Greater Napanee website. Thank you to Sarah Williams for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about Gananoque's role in the new Flixbus pilot program.
Thank you, Dinah. A new travel option is coming to Gananoque as council has approved a six-month pilot project to bring the Flixbus service directly to the downtown core. At a special meeting on July 24th, council voted unanimously to allow Flix North America Incorporated to establish a passenger stop in front of Town Hall adjacent to 30 King Street East. The stop will serve the Ottawa to Toronto corridor with two eastbound and westbound trips operating Thursdays through Mondays. The service is set to launch on July 31st and run until January 14th. A long-term agreement could follow depending on usage and operational feedback. Council also approved a bylaw change to formally designate the area as a passenger loading and unloading zone. The location, already a no parking space, requires no loss of public parking and will be marked with a Flixbus signage and QR code for real-time tracking and ticket purchases. The project is part of the town's broader strategy to assess local transit feasibility. During the pilot, staff members will monitor traffic flow, safety, and public interest. If successful, the town will consider a standard annual occupancy fee of $1,007 for continued use of the space, following the model used for seasonal patio programs.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about liability concerns related to a parkour class in Greater Napanee.
At their meeting this week, Greater Napanee Council approved the addition of a new facility rental category for passive park space meant for commercial or sport use. In the absence of this option, community groups, businesses, instructors, or teachers cannot book open park space to conduct their activities or events. Staff recently became aware that Pegasus Movement Academy was hosting parkour classes in municipal parks. Parkour is an activity that combines running, jumping, and climbing. It started in France and is now popular worldwide. Staff noted that the academy's operator carries $5 million in commercial general liability insurance, but confirmation will be needed that the town is listed as an additional insured on the policy. With the new category, booking confirmations will be accompanied by proof of insurance for the town of Greater Napanee. Director of Parks, Recreation and Culture, Chris Brown, explained why they needed to add the new category.
Just generally, right off the bat, staff were concerned about the liability risk that this posed to the town. In absence of any formal rental or operating agreement, we just asked that the activities be paused until such time that we could figure something out. We did reach out to our insurer with the town. They provided recommendations. They did confirm that our concerns are valid, particularly regarding the use of municipal infrastructure without appropriate permits in place. This is specific to a business, a commercial entity that's running a business in the park. It's not intended for, you know, your general family to go have a picnic. It is a public space still, but being able to book it would allow us to have a bit of a calendar there to know who's there when, and then that would help just enforce things and keep our eye on it as well.
Staff originally proposed a rate of $25 an hour, but Councillor Bill Martin voiced his concerns.
I kind of have a problem with this $25 an hour thing. I think it's excessive for kids to just run and play and jump and, you know, have a good time. Because for me, that's what our parks are for. And I think we're getting into an area where the parks won't be able to be used unless we charge money for it. And I hate to see things like this where we're discouraging people from using the parks. Like, I can see one event a year or whatever people use the park for. But when somebody's using it and it's for kids, It's not a business where she's in it just for the money. So I have a big concern with that $25 an hour fee for children's activities.
CAO Matthew Grant explained why the town would be charging for the space.
What we're talking about here, and I think, you know, what this would fall into is if businesses are operating in the park. So in this case, it's parkour, but if it were a different kind of business that might be operating in the park, there would be a fee for that. I mean, the fee structure is certainly something that we could talk about with council. But the premise here is not individual use or group use or birthday parties or those sort of stuff. But if someone is operating a for-profit business, then that would be fall under the bylaw.
Grant explained how the new fee structure may come to be.
The fee structure would come back at a later date, and I don't think would represent a burden at this point in time. When the fee structure comes back, staff will make a recommendation. Council might ask us to sharpen our pencil a bit with different types of user groups or businesses, so that sort of thing. But ultimately, the fee that is charged for this kind of activity is council's decision to make and council's alone.
Brown spoke about different possibilities and options staff may have to consider in the future.
Council is supportive of the academy and what they're doing. We're just trying to clean up some legal things. And this type of thing is new to us. And there'll be many different things like this that arise in the future that where we have to sort of think about it, adjust how we're doing business. And it is not uncommon. I did do some research of other municipalities in our area. They do rent out passive park space for things like fitness classes and stuff like that. The fee is not important to me. What's important to me is that we make sure that we have the proper permits, agreements, if you will, in place, and that we get insurance naming the town as additional insured so that we're protected if anything were to happen. The fee can be discussed for sure in more detail.
The Academy's operator, Cora Wright, details her history and career in coaching.
My love of coaching actually began here in Napanee 30 years ago, and have traveled Ontario and New Brunswick doing what I love for the last 30 years. Since I started coaching when I was 13 here in Napanee, I've received multiple certificates in education related to gymnastics, parkour, trampoline, tumbling, and more. And adaptive coaching as well, which means working with people with autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, things like that.
Wright speaks about her class and their focus on safety.
Our classes aren't about stunts or reckless behavior. They're about learning how to move safely and confidently through our environment. We do focus on falling techniques, coordination, body awareness, and respect for the spaces we use. We teach children to take care of themselves, but also the world around them. Some perceptions of parkour are often shaped by viral video stunts. These viral video stunts are not what we're about at PMA. We don't even resemble them remotely. We operate under strict safety guidelines with training and experience. Our students are trained in every class from day one to know what's safe and how to assess an area for safety. And these kids are 3 years old and up. So a three-year-old is trained how to fall safely, how to assess their environment, how to decide whether or not an area is safe for them to jump on, to climb on, before they even approach it.
Wright noted the impact her classes had in just a short time.
To see the kids' reaction when people are walking by the bridge or driving over the bridge or walking through the park, and just the cheers that they get and just the interest that they get. These people have grown through the program, even though it's only been in operation for such a short time. And I truly do believe that PMA makes Napanee stronger.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a new program aiming to combat youth homelessness in Northumberland County.
Night Stop is a new program which pairs vetted youth with approved homes in the community for short or long-term accommodation. Rebound Child and Youth Services Executive Director Sam Rockbrun says youth experiencing homelessness in the county is on the rise.
So Night Stop is a youth homelessness prevention program. Rebound Child and Youth Services has funding to support a pilot of this program through 2025. We're really excited for this. And Night Stop is empowering community hosts. So we're looking for volunteers in the community to open up their spare bedrooms to support youth ages 16 to 24 to prevent long-term homelessness.
So what, I guess let's get into the need a bit here for this. What is the need in this in the county? Do you have stats on the level of homelessness of youth at this point?
Yeah, so Rebound has been working in youth homelessness prevention for quite a while now, and what we've been seeing, especially over the last 4 or 5 years, is that our numbers are doubling each year. 2 years ago, we saw, I believe, 3 or 4 youth. Last year, we ended up seeing 7 youth. We are anticipating those numbers again doubling this year, so 14 or 15 youth, which is quite significant when you think about the youth population in Northumberland County and also just how invisible youth homelessness is.
So you've issued a press release saying we're opening up the referral for youth. Let's walk through that process. What is that, and how would a youth get involved?
Yeah, so we are super excited to be opening up youth referrals. So this started last week. So the referral process for youth is how they really can join the Next Stop program. Our team has gone through the process and really had it down to about a 3 or 4 hour process. So from the time of the youth either submitting an application, a trusted adult submitting an application, or a community agency submitting an application, our team is able to review the initial referral application, to meet with the youth, to do a detailed risk assessment, do a risk management piece, and then actually start to place the youth with the host family. Pending availability, we should be able to do that same day, which is really exciting.
So let's talk about a little more on the so you have a youth, and they've been vetted, and they're on board now. What's the next step of getting them into an approved room or house?
Yeah, so once they've gone through that kind of risk assessment and referral process, we then show them our available house, or we'll pick a house that'll be a good fit for them and show them that profile. From there, depending on the time of day, we will bring them over to the host family home. We actually do a warm transfer, which is really nice. So that way, a 16, 17-year-old isn't showing up at a brand new spot and feeling uncomfortable. Our staff are going with them, being able to tour them around the house, show them the room they'll be staying in, introduce them to the host, really make sure that they're feeling comfortable and the host is feeling comfortable in that process. It's really nice that we're able to do that. Just nothing is worse than showing up. I'm a full adult, and I can imagine showing up at someone's house and not knowing what to do. So having that warm transfer is helpful. We also have an on-call support, so if something happens through the process, whether it's a youth or whether it's the host, our staff are always available to answer questions or to support, so it's never that they're on their own. So a couple months ago, we had talked about our host recruitment process. We are still recruiting for hosts. We've been really lucky so far to have onboarded 3 hosts, 2 in Port Hope and 1 in Coburg. So we are continuing to look for hosts, especially across the county as a whole. That entire process is up on our website. If anyone is interested in opening up a spare bedroom, we definitely need more hosts, just as we talked about that need earlier in this interview. So definitely encourage everyone to go visit our website to sign up to be a host. There is another vetting process we go through. Everyone who's in this program is getting well vetted because there is so much involved. So we are looking for hosts, but can definitely check it out.
Now, if I'm interested, either I have a home to a room to spare, or a youth, where do I go, and how do I access the documents or the information I need to get into the program?
Yep. So for our youth, our referral form is on our website. So if you type in rcys.ca/nightstop, you'll be able to find that. Same with our volunteers. The information is on that same webpage. You'll reach out to Grace Riley, who is our Nightstop family coordinator and youth client caseworker, and she'll be able to take you through those next steps. She'll actually be the contact that you'll talk to the entire time. But all of that is on our website. If you're following us on social media, you'll also see it there, because we keep posting about Nightstop. We want to get the word out there. And we do send out regular newsletters as well. So if anyone is on our newsletter, they should be receiving those updates.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, July 31st, daytime high of 26 degrees, a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, August 1st, it's going to be 24, more sunny and clear conditions forecasted. Moving into the weekend,
Saturday, August 2nd, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 27. Sunday, August 3rd, daytime high of 27. It's going to be a beautiful, picture-perfect long weekend here in the city of Kingston. And then moving to the start of next week, the holiday Monday, daytime high of 26, feeling closer to 28 with light humidity factored in.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Sunny La
Kwe.
Y-E-B snack seal.
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Kwe, Nindaluizi Pam Pometer. Hi, my name is Pam Pometer, and I'm your host for the Mi'kmaq episodes of Words and Culture. I'm a citizen of the Mi'kmaq Nation and a member of one of the First Nations that make up our larger nation. It's called Eel River Bar First Nation, but we call it Ugbaganjig, which really means where the Eel River meets the Atlantic Ocean, right at the Bay of Chaleur. To me, it's home. Nimitginen, home. Today's show is something really special. Bernie Francis is not just a Mi'kmaq speaker, but he's an actual linguist who studies languages. He literally wrote the orthography for the Mi'kmaq language. I was so captivated by his stories that sometimes I forgot I was even hosting this show. I know you'll love him too. Here's my conversation with Bernie Francis. Kwe, hello, Bernie. Medwilleen, how are you?
Oh, Pam, Willie. I'm also very flattered to be interviewed by you.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, not only am I happy that it's you, it's also that we get to talk about something amazing. There's always so many negative things in the media, but today we get to talk about the Mi'kmaq language. And I was thinking, who better to have on this show than someone who is a Mi'kmaq linguist? And I know lots of listeners will be thinking, yeah, okay, what is a linguist and what kind of training goes into it? Because certainly just because I can speak the English language, that doesn't make me a linguist.
Right. We're talking since 1974. I had a visitor that I had known for about a year prior to 1974, a good guy. He was originally from Akron, Ohio, and got some of his academic training in Alberta, and then he studied linguistics at University of Toronto. And so I met him, and what he was doing there, first of all, was a guy by the name of Gordon MacDonald. Gordon was from Membertou. So he met Doug Smith in Toronto. So Doug was explaining to him that he was ready to do his research for his dissertation for his PhD in linguistics. And but he was wondering, what to do it on. You know, Gordon said, why don't you try Mi'kmaq? At that time, it was Mi'kmaq, you know. And Doug took him up on it. But the only reason why he took him up on it is because he liked to sound Mi'kmaq. So anyway, Doug suddenly arrives. Well, not suddenly, but he finally arrives around 1973 in Membertou, and he gets a place. And so Doug had already at that time did a little bit of investigation on me. And because we had talked before, we were good friends, and he liked me, I liked him, you know. But one day he shows up in my house, sat down next to the kitchen table, and he pulls out these old documents that were written by a missionary priest in your area of the world.
Yeah.
So Doug brings these books that were written probably around, probably before 1938, around that time. So finally he said, I got a question for you. And I said, what is it? So he opened one of the books and he says, sit down and have a look at this. And when he opened it up in front of me, I said, well, that's in Mi'kmaq, looks like, I said. He said, well, can you read any of it? I said, no. No. Why can't you read it? I said, well, because, you know, I just never really learned how to read Mi'kmaq. He said, did you ever try? I said, no, never tried. So he said, have a look at it. So I looked at it, you know, and see what was there. I couldn't believe it myself that within few minutes, I was able to figure it out word for word. You know, so finally, to make a long story short, I sat there in front of Doug for about an hour going through. I became sort of hooked on what I was reading here. You know, it's all religious stuff or something or other. But the fact that I could read it was something else. I actually figured it out as I was reading it, you know. So then after some time, Doug is sitting there with that familiar smirk on his face that I used to notice when something would catch him, you know. So he said, have you ever considered studying linguistics? And I said to Doug, I said, you know, Doug, I probably would be if I knew what the hell it was. I couldn't even pronounce linguistics at the time, you know. So I said, he said, he laughed, of course. So he explained it, he explained what linguistics was. And again, I felt kind of interested, you know, about what he was saying, even though I'd never, at that point, I hadn't studied linguistics, though I was already doing work on the language, but as a court worker, I was running a court worker program for our people at the time, because I caught on that they were treated very badly in court, my own people. And the only way that I would have known that is I got a job with the John Howard Society.
I'm going to stop right there because what comes next is super fascinating. And yes, our conversation takes a bit of a pit stop. Bernie realized that Mi'kmaq people who were going to court were pleading guilty to all kinds of crimes, mostly misdemeanors, because they didn't understand the English language. The Canadian Bill of Rights at the time didn't specifically guarantee the right to a translator in court, but some of the court decisions developed such that it was considered part of the right to a fair hearing. Nowadays, of course, the right to an interpreter in court is protected in Section 14 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that's a right that's critical to Indigenous language speakers, especially if their language is their first language.
Well, our people didn't know that.
No.
You know, so of course they wouldn't ask because they don't know. And the judges knew that probably, but they didn't say anything at the time. So anyway, so when I saw this was going on, I said, my God, you know, this is not good. So I didn't really do anything at that time until one guy from Eskizoni came to me one day. This is before the court started, and we're out in the hallway, not exactly in the courtroom yet. And he says to me, come here, I want to talk to you. He was very excited. But he was telling me, he said, look, they're charging me with this and that. He said, I wasn't even around at the time, you know, so he was quite adamant about that. So I said, okay, what you do there, and we're speaking in Mi'kmaq the whole time. I said, go in there, and when the judge calls your name, you get up and you go in front of the judge, and the judge will read a charge to you. Whether you understand it or not, he'll read a charge. And then at the end of it, he's going to say to you, do you plead guilty or not guilty, Mr. Gugu? And you just say not guilty. And then later on, we'll have a look at it. Legal aid was just beginning at that time, by the way, at that time. So we're talking about 1971 or 1970. Mm-hmm. It was just beginning. There was only one lawyer in town. Fortunately, he was a good guy. And I had already introduced myself to him and told him the story. Yes, he said, bring them in, you know, meaning our own people.
Yeah.
So anyway, this guy, we're all sitting in a courtroom, and I had already told him what to do. And finally, his name gets called, and he goes up to the front. And the judge does exactly as I thought he would. He would read the charges, and then he turns to him. He said, what do you plead, Mr. Gugu? Are you guilty or not guilty? Guilty, he said. I said, what? I was ready to jump up and choke him.
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, when... of course, he's going to get 10 days or 15 days in jail, whatever it was, you know. And as he's going out the door, I left the courtroom and chased after him in the hallway. And I said, gee, what happened? I said, I told you to plead not guilty to these. Yeah, but he said, the way the judge was looking at me, and I didn't like standing there in front of people, you know. And that's typical of our people. That's typical of our people, you know. You kind of don't look at an elder directly in the face, you know what I mean? It's disrespectful, and it's almost like a kind of like animals, you know, who challenge one another, you know. It's a deadly eye contact. Well, he didn't want any of that. So he just the fastest way to get out of there was to plead guilty. So he pleaded guilty, just like everything else. It was then that I went back home, and I sat down with the Union of Nova Scotia Indians leaders at the time, and I said, look, here's the situation. I explained everything to them, and I said, I'm damn angry, I said, because our people are just, it kind of reminds me of a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Up, plead guilty, off to jail, and then that's it. So anyway, they understood, fortunately. So they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, we have to start some kind of a court worker program or something like that. And they said, yes, okay. Well, I said, will you help me write a proposal to the government? They said, yes, indeed, we will. Anyway, I think it was about a month. The notice arrived from the government. I opened it up. There was a check, $56,000, everything I asked for. So that's how we started. I started the court worker program at the time. And from that point on, I visited a lawyer, and I said, you be ready for me, because I'll be bringing people in. All right. Mm-hmm. So for a little while, our people went to the courtroom, and then they would plead. Most of the time, they were still pleading guilty. So then I put the notice out, and we had what was called Micmac Magazine at the time. It's a little newspaper that came out every month. Roy Gould was the editor then. And so it came out, and I had a little notice in there that said, from now on, anyone that is charged with anything, plead not guilty and contact me. And I had my contact numbers there. And well, it started. The contact started. You know, and my late wife, actually, she died a few years ago, but she said to me, why did you give them our number? They're calling us at 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, well, I said, unfortunately, I said, it's the way it is, you know, I have to deal with it. So suddenly, everybody started to plead not guilty, our people, you know. Then before long, it got to the point where the prosecutors hated me. The judges hated me, and the RCMP, they sicked the RCMP on me on the weekends, just hoping that I would make these great grave mistakes on the highway or something, you know. And that is because suddenly the prosecutors had to work for their convictions.
What a story. Bernie was just 22 years old at the time, and he could already see the injustice that was harming our people. And that was all because of the colonizer's language was being used to effectively persecute Mi'kmaq people. All of that to say that Bernie's love of the language was really instilled in him with the defense of his people in court. But let's get back to the linguistics of the language.
To go back to Doug said to me, after we talked about linguistics and when he told me what it was, I said, yeah, I guess I wouldn't mind studying linguistics. I said, but where would I have to go? I said, I have a family here. He said, you don't have to go anywhere. He said, I'm the professor. I'm your teacher. And we started working almost immediately. I'll tell you, I absolutely fell in love with what I was learning at the time. Doug was an excellent teacher, and I just loved linguistics. I just it was like I took to it like a duck to water. Aww. And I just so enjoyed it. But it took about maybe 2 years before I got the lingo down well, you know, because you're practically speaking another language for a while until you get on to what all of these terms mean and so on. So we started in 1974 because a man on the reserve who was an educator, his name was Peter Christmas. I call him the mastermind of what we were doing. He's the guy that gave us the mandate to come up with a writing system that's easy to learn for the children. And of course, at that time, you know, Pacific system was around, but that wasn't so easy to learn. There was too much guesswork involved. Mm-hmm. And then prior to Pacific, there was a missionary who published a dictionary. He was a Baptist missionary, Silas T. Rand, who published a dictionary in 1888. So we looked at all the stuff, we knew what the problems were with those orthographies. That's why they didn't catch on. So Doug said, well, he said, we'll have to do better. I said, I guess we do. I said, because they're not going anywhere. Nobody's reading them or writing them. So we set to work. When we were developing it, of course, we had to find out what is the sound system in this language. We had to find that out first. So we worked, took every word, and we just conjugated it, took every noun and declined it, you know, figuring out the sounds, you know. And after about 3 years or something, we figured out that we had 27 distinctive sounds in the Mi'kmaq language. Now, compare that to English. English has about, depending on the dialect, because Newfoundland has 5 different dialects of English. And 2 of them, by the way, need a translator. That's how different it is. So let's say English has about between 50 and 55 sounds. So compared to Mi'kmaq, we only had 27 sounds. So once we figured out, okay, I think we pretty well have, the sound system mapped out. Now we have to choose an orthography that represents that sound system. So I said, all right. So we began. After about a year or so, we came up with an orthography, and it was my job to go out and test it on the various reserves. I would go to Wahmatgook, which is next to Bedeck, and I would test it out, and it would be going along, and suddenly someone would give me a word, and I said, oh, geez, you know, I don't know how to handle that. I said, all right, so back to the drawing board I would go, you know, and I would say to Doug, Doug, you know, it's not quite right yet. We have to do this. So Doug would work with me again, you know, and helping me out and teaching me at the same time. Before long, you know, after a couple of weeks, we'd come up, oh, yes, we know what's going on. Here's what we're going to do with this. So this kept going on. I'd go, you know, make changes and add a letter or something, or delete a letter or something. And then we would, you know, do this for a while. After about maybe 4 or 5 times of testing them, finally, in 1980, we knew at that time we had a polished product. And Doug thought about it, and I thought about it, and I said, oh, my God, I think I know what this means. It means, I'm talking in my own mind at that time, Doug's going to leave me. Because we got to be such good friends. We're working in a small office. We're discussing language every day of the week. I wouldn't have got that at university, you see. I would have went to 2 classes a week, and that would have been it. But with Doug, every day, we were a steady diet of the Mi'kmaq language and the ins and outs. And, you know, it's almost like studying, quantum mechanics. Yeah. You know, because we had to really dissect that language, you know, to find out what makes it tick. And finally, I felt I had gone back several hundred years. That gave me that feeling that, by God, you know, I think I have an idea about how our language sounded like way back when, you know, because sometime after 1700s, particularly the letter of 1750, the language was quite a bit different at the time. And that was dictated to by a chief from Chapel Island Reserve. And Father Meyer, who was another missionary around, let's say, he arrived around 1734, and he stayed with us. I think he died in around 1763. But he worked on the hieroglyphic system and was not interested in teaching us the Roman alphabet at the time. And he said, when he was asked that question, he said, I don't want them, meaning us, to read anything else except biblical stuff and catechisms and things like that, you know. But anyway, I got to realize, okay, I have an idea about what our language sounded like back 300 years ago. And I think it's probably, you know, it's still pretty close. So, you know, that's what happened. And then, so I realized, okay, our language sounded a particular way. There's certain sounds that don't exist anymore, such as an SH, for example. Shh, that sound, you know, that doesn't exist in our language anymore. Like Sahamau, which is the word for chief, at that time would have been like shugamo.
Oh.
See, that sound is completely gone. And then, of course, the letter R existed, you know, but it doesn't exist anymore. Anything that's an R that comes into our language will assimilate to an L. Yeah, after time, you know, you kind of get a feeling about not just a linguistic knowledge, but a feeling about how words should be spelt and so on. Anyway, to make a longer story short, Doug left in 1980. He said, I feel pretty redundant now. And we said our goodbyes and I missed him. But one day he left me with something which I never did forget, because it was something crucial, and I don't think it would have happened if I wasn't so frustrated with the spelling of one word. We had a difficult time. So I said one day to Doug, I said, Doug, let's spell the damn thing this way. Let's spell that word this way. I mean, who the hell's going to care? Who's going to notice? So Doug turned around at the time and said to me, you never dictate to the language as to how it should be represented. You must allow the language to dictate to you. You know, now he may as well have been sitting with me for the next 40 years, because with that statement left with me, he took off, you know, and it was bothersome, that statement, but I stuck with it, because sometimes you get frustrated and you want to write it any old way, you know, just to get out of the frustration. But I never fell for that. In the end, I paid attention to what Doug had said at the time, and that statement continued to be my teacher, even though Doug wasn't around. You know, he left for greener pastures. My greatest fear was getting into some kind of a car accident at the time, because if I got killed, everything would have been down the tubes, right? All the work. So I was really afraid. So I called the Eskasoni Council, and I said, I'd like to start rudimentary techniques of reading and writing Mi'kmaq in Eskasoni. And I like to teach people how to read with this new system. But who I would need mostly are teachers who are teaching native children on the big reserve of Eskasoni. And I want to make sure that they're confident enough where they could develop curriculum materials. They're the ones I need the most. And they understood right away. And they immediately contacted a few teachers. And then I started once a week. I went to Eskasoni for about 2.5 hours, teaching them this new orthography. And it was so simple, because to people who spoke the language, it was absolutely simple. I mean, Doug and I followed what is known as the phonemic principle. That means for every one letter, there's one sound. And for every one sound, there's one letter, you know? Okay. Now, there's no such thing. I mean, nobody would come up with an orthography that has silent letters. I mean, what would that do? I mean, yeah, English has them, but it wasn't because they put them in. They were correct at one point. Like the word, let's take the word night, for example, N-I-G-H-T. Mm-hmm. Well, there's only three sounds to that, N-I and T, night, mm-hmm. You see? But So therefore, you have GH in the middle, which are silent. Why would they put them there? Well, they didn't. What happened was when the migration happened in Europe, right? And you get all of these people ending up around England. And there was a separation of 700, 800, 900 years. Naturally, the languages will change. So the language did change in around Britain area, but they didn't change the orthography with it. So that is why night is still spelled N-I-G-H-T. But prior to it arriving in that area, it would have been nicht, that word for night. So in that respect, the G and the H are pronounced. Nobody would just put in silent letters for no good reason, you know. It just doesn't make any sense. So the teachers learned in that 10-week period, everybody that was in that class, including non-teachers, picked up on the language quite easily. And sure enough, the teachers did exactly what I had hoped that they would do, and that's to start developing curriculum materials. And they went ahead. I was so proud and very happy.
I wanted to know one last thing from Bernie. So I asked him, if there was one thing people should know about the Mi'kmaq language, what would it be?
I totally relied on elders. It was their patience and their understanding that kept me going. Because, you know, first of all, I always mentioned Peter Christmas because it was Peter that was the brains behind it all. We were just the foot soldiers, Doug and I, you know.
Right.
And we had to go around and talk to people. But I really, going to people like, in Member 2, there was Pauline Bernard, Frank Doucette, Carl Gould, you know, all these people that I relied on that I thought were very good speakers, and they are. And then Escasoni, there's one lady that's known as Dr. Granny. Her name is Margaret Johnson, and Margaret and Wilfred Prosper. And then, of course, I went to New Brunswick, and I went to Listigouge, and I talked to elders there all over the place. So the elders from, let's say, the Maritime Provinces, were without them, none of this would have been possible, or it wouldn't have been possible in a way where I actually feel I have a well-rounded knowledge about our language, you know, from the elders to the young ones and so on. They were a tremendous, tremendous help, you know. And for payment, only one asked for payment, and that was Dr. Granny. She asked me for a pair of sheep-lined slippers after 25 years of work.
Do you see why Bernie Francis is so respective in Mi'kma'ki, our home Mi'kmaq territory? He has always put the love of our people first, even when it didn't always make him very popular in the non-Indigenous community. His work developing the orthography for the Mi'kmaq language is a real gift to all of us, and also a legacy for future generations that'll help ensure that our Mi'kmaq language will never be lost. My biggest takeaway is that it's never too late to learn my language, but that learning about the language and that cultural context is part of learning how to speak the language. Well, Aliyog, thank you all for listening. I'm Pam Palmiter, and this is Words and Culture. Namultas, see you again.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Hausin Dang King Sam.
Namultas.
Ninuis ahaha miku kwa kwal.
Kachunautano.
Wapamatin mina.
Tune in to Word Labs Out Loud, your weekly writing spark on CFRC 101.9. Join your host, Arrow McCauley, for a free-flow show where words, ideas, and music mingle. Each week, we sit down with one of the local authors and artists leading writing workshops through the Word Labs program. They'll share their stories, their insights, and maybe even a few secrets of their craft. Get your pens ready. After the chat, you'll get writing prompts to stretch your imagination, all set to a soundscape designed to help you focus, relax, and create.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course.